Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 35 of the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Woodzik. This episode is all about the Zigzag Festival. Really awesome festival happening right now at Annex Theater, featuring world premiere plays by six young female playwrights. This idea was the brainchild of Catherine Blake Smith, who also curates Spin the Bottle over at Annex. We love you, Annex Theater. So, Catherine Blake Smith, Deo Anderson, L. Nicole Cabe, Amy Escobar, Xiang Yim, Courtney Meeker was unable to join us, but she's been on the podcast two times already, so we already know and love Courtney. Sad that she couldn't join us, but she was there with us in spirit in these interviews. And check out this festival. It's only $10 to come see one night. $5 if you're a TPS member. You can get a festival pass for $15. More information is at annextheater.org. The festival runs through August 19th, and you're going to want to come for both nights so you can see all six world premiere plays. Check it out. This episode is sponsored by Hedgebrook. Hedgebrook is the retreat on Whidbey Island, but it's more than that. It's programming out in the world supporting the voices of strong women writers. Coming up, some upcoming Hedgebrook events. The Hedgebrook Open House is September 26th. It's a Saturday from 1 to 4 on Whidbey Island. It's a huge party. There's going to be readings by Erica Bauermeister, Stephanie Kalos, Karen Finifrock, and Donna Mascolta. It's free. There's awesome food. Check it out. What else? Allison Bechtel. Yeah, the Allison Bechtel who came up with the Bechtel test. Hedgebrook is co-presenting an evening with her at Town Hall with Seattle Arts and Lectures. That's happening October 22nd, which is the same night as Lit Crawl, and Hedgebrook also has a reading for that. Get all the up-to-date news and all things Hedgebrook at hedgebrook.org. Also on Facebook, facebook.com/Hedgebrook. On Twitter, at @WriteHedgebrook. All right, without any further ado or commotion, please enjoy episode 35 with the talent and playwrights of the Zigzag Festival. All right, I'm really excited to welcome Catherine Blake Smith and playwright Xiang Yim to the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm sorry, I tripped over that a little bit. I get nervous about pronouncing. This is already off to a great start, but I'm not going to hit record because it's about adding color to the landscape of this interview. You're both playwrights and directors for the Zigzag Festival, which is currently running at Annex Theater. So tell me about, I was there opening night, and then you had two opening nights. Tell me about how the reception has been this weekend for the shows. This week.
It's week, and that's the other crazy part about it. So it's an off-night show at Annex, which means that right after we opened our main stage show, we turned around and did it again so that our theater is never dark. And on Tuesdays and Wednesdays for the next 2 weeks, there will be a whole new set of shows. So Tuesday night, technically opening night of the entire festival, and we had three plays, three directors, three playwrights, and then Wednesday, Xiang and myself included, premiered as directors on Wednesday night. So although I didn't originally anticipate it that way, it ended up being another opening night for everybody involved. And that was really exciting. So, yeah, good responses and, yeah, good turnout. And having so many artists involved in the project means a lot of people come. So there's six playwright directors, 10 actors, and 4 or 5 designer production crew. I think there's actually like 6 total in terms of crew. So, yeah, there's a lot of people.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
As the curator of the festival, how did this idea come to you, and how did you put it into action?
So I honestly was just laying in bed late at night thinking about all the people I knew who did all the things. Who
right.
Write, direct, dramaturg, produce, all of it. And I got up and started making a list, and I realized they were all women. And I was like, how can I bring all of these people together? and thought about different projects that I've seen. 1448 Festival, Annex, I've only heard about it, I never actually saw it, but Annex used to do a thing called Hot House, so they would invite a playwright to come. I think it was like a 2-week process and really work and develop a play and then produce the play, and all sorts of other events that I've seen of bringing together multiple artists to produce one night of theater, and just started inviting people from there. So Shi Young I invited because I knew you through playwriting class, and said, do you ever want to direct? So that was also part of it, was looking at people who I knew through various disciplines. And so Courtney Meeker I know primarily as a playwright, but I know she can direct. I've seen her do it. And Amy Escobar as well. I'd seen her direct, but wasn't too familiar with her writing, things like that. So bringing everybody together in that way, too, that was pretty magical, I think, how it all came together.
Do you want to talk about gender parity in theater a little bit?
Sure.
Why it's important? Why this festival is exactly what more theaters need to be doing?
Most of the time, you're seeing plays by men or directed by men, especially on the larger stages, and constantly in the conversation happening, like on Twitter and Facebook and everything, there's always this, like, now I can't remember, but the woman who stood up at, it was on the East Coast, right?
At the summit.
Elisa, can't remember her name. I follow her on Twitter, I know. But, you know, just being able to stand up in front of an artistic team of a repertory theater and say, here are your numbers, it's mostly men. And knowing that and then looking around Seattle and seeing where women are produced. I used to work with Macho Monkey Productions, which focuses on women, women's work, and Live Girls Theater is solely female playwrights and directors. And Annex inadvertently produces a lot of women's work. So originally when I thought of the idea, I didn't put it together that Annex would be the place to produce it. And then we had our request for proposal process open up, and that's when I submitted it. And realized, oh, Annex would actually be the perfect place to produce this, because we're all about creating new work and trying things that have never been done before. So, yeah.
Right on.
Yeah.
Tell me about both of the plays that you have written and where the inspiration for them came from.
I'll let Shi Young take this one first. Yeah, so I usually write comedies, like modern comedies with modern dialogue, and most of my plays have Asian American characters in them, and which I still love to do, but I thought for this, since it's so new, I wanted to do something completely different, either in a completely different world or different time period. And through the zigzag process, Courtney was matched as my dramaturg, and she was just so amazing and so supportive, and she suggested, what if you wrote a play about girls in a gang? And she suggested this book called Don't Call Us Malls. And it's about the women who were involved in the John Dillinger gang.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there's a lot of really cool information about how they were tracked, what kind of lives they led, just like how they were persecuted by the laws and how they were portrayed in the media and also glamorized at the same time. So that was kind of what was inspiration. They have like cool excerpts of love letters in there too.
Oh,
so
wow.
A lot of stuff for inspiration. But yeah, it was thanks to Courtney. So. Yeah. So my play is almost like therapy. You know, that thing where you just write out what you know, what you're feeling. And, every time I watch it, I realize that each character is, like, a different, like, aspect of myself, an aspect of my personality kind of split into a new person. But I also, I'm always enamored by theater in that, you know, you can do whatever you want. You know, you can have a ghost on stage. And so I wanted to incorporate theatricality to it in some way, some sort of fun stage magic. So I kept finding opportunities to incorporate that as I was writing it. And actually, my inspiration to even start writing, we did have a process where we drew ingredients out of a bowl of just phrases and words.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I originally had proposed the idea as, like, just to, you know, get some words on the page. Just, okay, I'm writing. I'm going to sit down and write. What do I write about? Great, I'll write about this. And two of the phrases that came out were actually Nicole's phrases that she wrote, and she was my director for the process. So they were bad theater and girly board games.
Oh, my gosh.
So the scene where, which is one reason why I cannot cut this scene, because it's why the play exists, but the scene where Elliot is complaining about Kayleen falling asleep during his show because one of the actors sounds like Jeff Bridges, that was the very first scene that I wrote. And it kept moving around, and so it used to start off the play, and yeah. So it kept moving around in the play, and I can't cut it yet because it's why the play is there. So I'm also greatly indebted to Nicole for why my play exists.
Yeah. So this the Dream Phone is like, it was an actual game.
Yes, Dream Phone's only a game. I bought the game.
I saw it,
that's
but I've never,
that's my
like,
game. Yeah.
I had never come across it in my...
You never played it?
I never played it.
Oh, it's super weird. Yeah, you dial in, so it's kind of like Clue, but for like teenage girls. So the phone selects somebody, and you've got all these cards with numbers like 555-0515, and you dial all the different boys, there's 24 of them, and you dial them, and they answer the phone and say, like, he's not at the mall, he's not wearing yellow, you know, he doesn't like to hang out at the beach. It's a lot of knots, actually, as opposed to, like, what he actually likes to do. And the premise of the game is to find out who has a crush on every single girl there. It's not even just one. And the point is to find him first. So in the world of the game, I guess you find out who likes all of you. I'm not sure what the game makers intended to happen afterward, but... And then you just restart the game if you want and play again. Yeah.
I feel like I'd missed part of my childhood.
That was the one I remembered the most. And there were, I mean, when it first got brought up, Courtney, I think, immediately thought of Mall Madness and Mystery Date. And Mystery Date's been around since, like, the 60s. And, yeah. Mall Madness has been around since the 60s as well. But I never played those games.
I was super into Geo Safari. Like, that was the game that I played growing up. I had a Sega Game Gear.
Wow.
Oh. I had a Sega Game Gear, and I played Sonic the Hedgehog on it, and then I traded it to someone in middle school for a bunch of makeup. And how, like, twisted is that, right? Like, we did a trade, Sega Game Gear for makeup.
Yeah. I wasn't allowed to play video games when I was little, so there was a lot of, like...
Just absolutely not at
all. Yeah, just no video games. Yeah. So, it's probably why I have terrible... hand-eye coordination.
You didn't start. You probably won't have carpal tunnel as soon as the rest of us, right? Yeah. So why don't both of you talk about what it's been like, that relationship with your partner, playwright / director, that, I mean, is there sort of an artistic symbiotic relationship in that they're directing your piece, you're directing theirs? How has that relationship been experienced by both of you?
So... From my observations, I would say Xiang and I probably had very opposite experiences because Nicole is also working on another project currently, and I'll go ahead and bump it now in case she doesn't end up being able to talk about it. Copious Love Productions, opening Codename Kansas, an interpretation, I think, of the Wizard of Oz story, and I think it opens Halloween, and it's happening at 12th Avenue Arts. Yes. So she's... directing that. So she's in the middle of all of her pre-production process.
Wow.
So she and I had one or two rehearsals where we were in the same room together.
And that was it.
So I structured our rehearsal schedule based on her availability, all of the actor conflicts and everything, put it all together and realized, oh, okay, so it's pretty clear which play we're working on because when you're there, I'm not there, so you'll work on mine. And when I'm there, you're not there, so I'll work on yours. And we didn't really start working together until we got closer to the tech process. But she and I have a lot of similar thoughts about things, so it's been interesting to find our symbiosis through conversation, but it didn't become apparent in the room because we didn't have so many opportunities to work together. So as far as I've observed, that seemed to be a little bit different than what Xiang and Amy did.
Yeah, we were pretty much together for every single rehearsal, and I haven't directed anything since I was in college, and it was with two friends, and no technical pieces to it at all. It was just like lights up, lights down. So I was very overwhelmed directing, and I wanted to do her piece justice. So I think we really, Amy and I, co-directed more, and actually it was mainly her vision of the play.
It's just hers so specific. Has shadow puppets and blood, and it's... There's a lot of pieces to it.
Totally a lot of pieces. And I was like, I have no idea how to do this because I just write stuff and then I go, the director or the actors figure it out. So I learned so much from working with her. So we were pretty much in the rehearsal room together for both of rehearsals, except for one I decided to not go for my play, just so that the actors can have some like intimate time to work, because I have some really dark pieces in my play, so I wanted them to feel free to like move through it without me there. And I did a lot of like rewrites too, to try to like tighten things.
Yeah, that was the hardest part about the compressed schedule. Well, there are a lot of hard parts about a compressed schedule, but the thing that I felt too, especially being a new playwright, was I wanted to do a lot more changes and rewrites, and Nicole at a certain point said, no.
We're done.
Like, yeah, we're done. They just have to make it work, because you're going to overload the actors' brains, changing so many things. So the way that everything kind of shook out, not having as many people to read the pieces early on, for my process, like, I'm not as good as imagining what it will be like when an actor actually gets it. But then being able to come in and kind of watch it by checking in with the process on my play, and not actually be present for the table work and stuff that Nicole had did, but to see it manifest on stage was so cool. It was so cool. And there are so many that if I had directed it, it would have been a different piece, certainly, but I feel like it would not have... I don't know. It was just better because somebody else directed it, and it was better because Nicole did it. Like, there are so many parts I never would have thought of to add in that weren't necessarily in the script, but as a good director, you read between the lines, you know, and you fill it in. And you fill it in with the people who are in the room. So it was exciting to not necessarily be present for every moment of that process, but to get to see it unfold. So,
can you talk a little bit about your process as a writer versus your process as a director? And if they speak to each other at all?
They're very different. part of the process, and I actually have not had a chance to check in with everybody yet about how well this worked, but of setting deadlines for ourselves throughout the process. So we first met mid-February, and then we started setting deadlines for drafts, which I found very helpful. It's like, okay, it has to be in by April 30th,
right,
because everybody else is holding me accountable. And then as we got closer to the date, and you know, saying, okay, well, life happens, so it's going to be, you know, May 1st, and that's okay. And that's okay. But knowing that that was looming, but that the only thing keeping us all accountable was each other, which was really lovely, I think, as opposed to some mysterious overarching person. So that aspect of it, as compared to directing, which I do very intuitively, but having a tighter rehearsal schedule meant that I couldn't do that as much as I usually do. And just the nature of the play that I directed is more, I don't know if prescriptive is the right word, but since it's a reality TV show, just the blocking was kind of, like, the blocking, which I usually let happen in the room because it's conversation, it was like, well, it's a cooking show, so they would be at their stations. That's the blocking, right?
Right.
So I had to approach it a lot differently, and certainly in my writing, it was very intuitive. It was just whatever I was feeling was coming out, so, which feels different from your process, too, of writing outside of your traditional style, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, well, one thing that has been really great is just, like, the community that Catherine helped curate with the women, so I felt like I would write and then have ample opportunity to get feedback and support, and just, like, so I'm an introvert, so it's, like, time away to write and then come and then get feedback, and then I think directing was so different because you kind of have to be able to process in the moment and express what you're wanting right then.
There's a lot of improvisation. Yeah. While directing. Yeah.
And it was hard for me to do that because I need time to think, and it feels stressful to like make a decision. So it really, Amy and I worked together on this. Mm-hmm. So she's very good at, because she's also an actor, so she can just. And I'm like, oh, the thing, move here. It's just awkward sometimes. Yeah. So it was very different for me from being, like, a writer to directing. And I learned a lot about how to figure out how to enter more and say what I want to say in the moment. It's been a big learning experience.
Mm-hmm. How do you, because as an actress who directs as well, reading some articles that talk about the difference between female directors tend to use phrases like, do you understand what I'm saying? Qualifying what they're saying.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do you catch yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Because I catch myself doing that, especially when there's male actors in the room.
Yeah.
I haven't noticed it along gender binary lines, like, in the room itself, but I do a lot of, does that make sense?
Right.
Because somebody looks at you and they aren't necessarily, they're not actively responding because they're processing the information that you just gave them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I asked that question a lot. And I after I read, I think there was an article on HowlRound that covered it. And after that, I tried to dial it back a little bit. But it just, it still happens.
It sneaks in the back.
Yeah. And because, I try to run a very, I want to say, intuitive rehearsal room, but I like to have the actors be able to contribute in a way, which eventually leads to this room where, and not necessarily with this process, but I've watched it happen in other processes where when it comes time for me to make a decision because we're running out of time, it's a lot harder to kind of bring everybody together and say, okay, no, we're doing this now. You know, we don't have a lot of room to explore new ideas because we have to do this next week. So finding the way to transition, I guess, from being very open to what do you want to do? What scene do you want to work on right now? Not that I go that far, but letting people do what they need to do to get their work done, because later in the rehearsal process, it becomes about the director needing to do what they need to do, you know? And still meet everybody's needs. It's very hard. It's all very hard. And I like it.
Yeah, the negotiating the power dynamics.
Yeah.
One, trying to build camaraderie and trust in the room, mm-hmm. but then also knowing that you have power as a director is very interesting negotiating that.
Yeah, and then during our tech process, because we had a very truncated tech process, because Annex is so full of all these other performances, we only had an hour to tech our shows, and so you had to make a decision right away, you know, and both of the shows that Xiang and I directed, we didn't get a lot of our props until very close to the actual tech time because of the nature of the rehearsal schedule, and rehearsing off-site. Like, bless her. Xiang carried a lot of glass jars to rehearsals.
Alcohol cart.
I just had them imagine. I was like, just imagine you've got a utensil, you know, make it up for now. So, you know, having all of those items and realizing, oh wow, we're getting a lot of sensory input right now. It was very exciting to watch, and like that it did all come together within that hour, and watching everybody band together to make it happen was really exciting. Yeah.
What do you want audiences to know about this festival? Why is it important that they show up for this?
Because it's 6 new world premiere plays that it's amazing. It's amazing what came out, and the thematic synchronicity that came out of not even no planning on our parts, like the past and ghosts. And both nights on Tuesday and Wednesday, when I was watching, I realized I was putting together all of these themes in my mind. You know, that happened through other means. You know, none of us had a specific restriction in what we had to write except 20 minutes. And then we chose together as playwright directors, we chose the number of actors and then kind of made a decision about the gender breakdown between that to increase opportunities for young female actors as well, which was also a point of this festival. But it's a way to see how it all comes together, you know, that if you invite six people who all have something to say, they're going to say it. And, yeah, I think that's part of it, is to see that this is an opportunity for young female writers and directors, that we have something to say. And
we don't have to wait until we have a master's degree.
Exactly. We have something to say, and we can produce some pretty good shit. Like, they're entertaining evenings, you know? And we can do it on the set of the main stage, you know, and write something that's compelling enough that the main stage set kind of fades away to the background, right, and you are in an office, you know, an interview situation, or you are in the living room, or I'm guessing Mary probably lives in the studio apartment, right? Like, you are in a studio apartment going down to the depths of whatever, to her nightmares, you know, or you're in a post-apocalyptic world. Like, all of these things can happen, and it like gives me chills to think about that, you know, every person involved in this from the beginning had an idea that was then developed and supported by every single other person in the room. So nobody was doing this by themselves. And I think that's what I want people to see, is that, you know, everybody is an individual worth hearing, and that everybody has support around them. Yeah.
What advice do either one of you have for aspiring playwrights, directors, people who just want to get shit done, who maybe haven't had opportunities, and they're excited and hungry, and they just need a little bit of a sense of direction?
Just do it. Yeah, that was the big thing, was if this whole project idea had not been accepted by Annex, I was brainstorming ideas of how to do it on my own, basically, and that would be, you know, find the rehearsal space, find the performance space, and it still would be about... It mostly would be about getting the money. That's the biggest part, right? To produce anything. But being able to find somebody who agrees with your aesthetic and Annex... I mean, that's why I am on staff at Annex, because I fully support the mission of... Oh, I don't have it memorized, our mission statement. I used to.
I'll pull it up, I promise.
It's to produce bold new work in an environment of improbability and risk. Yeah.
Jinx, you owe me a Coke.
You know, it would have been about finding somebody else. In my mind, Annex is like that, you know, that patron of the arts, even though we are the arts, but... It was like going to somebody and saying, this is an idea I have. Do you agree with it? Let's produce it. So, to anybody who's interested in directing or writing, it's, you know, about finding your home and saying, I have something to say, or I have an idea of how to do it. Let's do it. And finding the people who want to work and show up and do the work.
Anything to add?
Yeah, so for me, I started getting in just from taking playwriting classes, because I just wanted to build some skills, but I got so much more out of it. I took Stephanie Tin's class, that's how I met Catherine, and she's just such a really wonderful, nurturing teacher, on top of being a brilliant playwright. But she really created a space so that the people that I've taken playwriting classes with, like 4 years ago, were still friends, and we still show up for each other. So that's really helped me, is having like a writing community. Even though I thought of writing as just a solitary act, for plays, I feel like you really need feedback. So just, you know, finding a community and telling people you're a playwright, and then going to plays and talking to people. And I just find Seattle theater scene has been so welcoming, mm-hmm. and so supportive. And I feel very still new at this, so it's just been so great.
Yeah, and you participated in the Seattle Fringe Festival,
yes,
recently. And how did... Because that seems like an opportunity where it's, I know other people, and then one person gets into the Fringe Festival and yeah. invites a bunch of other artists to come,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was fun. Yeah. Yeah, it was like 10 writers for one show.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
All right, so the Zig Zag Festival, it's running for 2 more weeks.
Mm-hmm.
People are going to want to go to annextheater.org to get their tickets. And you're going to want to find 2 different dates that you can come, because you're going to want to see all 6 plays.
Yes.
And Yeah, go support work by young local female playwrights, people. That sounded really accusatory, didn't it?
Yeah,
I'm saying it with a smile on my face.
And I'll also point out, tickets are $10, and if you choose to come back on another night, so if you come on a Tuesday and you want to come back on the following Wednesday, then you can get a discounted, we're calling it a festival pass, but there is a way to only pay $15 to see two shows as opposed to paying $20 to see two shows.
What a deal. And there's a bar.
Yeah.
And so you can
be drinking
while you watch things, which is always really fun. Thank you both for sitting down with me. Good luck with the rest of the run. I can't wait to see closing night.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, welcome everyone. This is the Zigzag Festival Podcast Part 2. I am joined virtually. This is an awesome experiment or a new frontier in my podcasting by L. Nicole Cabe and Deo Anderson. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So I was lucky enough to see opening night, the first of the two opening nights, and I look forward to coming back for closing night of the Zigzag Festival. Can both of you talk about how you were invited into this process by Catherine?
Yeah. Nicole, you want to hit it up first?
Sure. I think it was like this time last year where I got the initial email from Catherine, where she had proposed the Zigzag Festival as an off night to Annex, and we couldn't announce it. Because it wasn't official on the Annex page yet, but she was sending out a preliminary email to ask if people were available and interested, and I like Catherine a lot. I have great respect for her, so I said yes. And then I got a follow-up email a couple of months later that was like, hey, just checking to see if you're still interested, because I think she'd emailed like 20 people just to sort of gauge interest and availability, and being theater people, of course, not that many people were available, which is unfortunate, but I was still available at the time, and I was like, yeah, I'll totally do it. I'll put it on my calendar right now, and then we had our first meeting in January, I guess, so it was kind of a long initiation process as CBS sort of narrowed down the people that she wanted to invite and the people who were available. But I ended up making the cut, so that's cool.
Yeah, I had a similar experience. I actually, you know, only had sort of heard of CBS, a little bit, you know, removed from my social group, but I had seen some of her work and really respected her, and actually she saw me at an audition for Bunnies, and I ended up not being able to progress through the process because I took a different project, and when I sent that email, I was like, super bummed about it because I really wanted to work with her, work with Pamela, work with Annex, and I sent an email saying, like, I'm so sorry, I can't come to callbacks, and Catherine wrote me back and was like, hey, I've got this project and I'd really, really like to have you involved in it, and I was so pumped. I was like, well, there's a reason why I couldn't do Bunnies. It's because I needed to do this instead. And within a couple weeks, I was in the room with all the other ladies and super pumped about it.
Woohoo! So Catherine talked a little bit about how, about the process of choosing what you're writing about. And there's pulling ideas out of a hat. Can you talk about that a little bit? She was saying, Nicole, that she got a couple of your phrases that you had written down.
Yeah, we assigned ourselves a writing exercise, I guess, at like our second meeting, where we put in three words or phrases in a hat, like on folded up pieces of paper, so they were semi-anonymous. I mean, we all have really distinctive handwriting, so I guess it wasn't that anonymous, but we went around and drew them out of a hat, and, Catherine got two of mine. One was bad theater and, I forget what the other one was.
Girly board games.
Yeah, something like that. But bad theater was definitely one of them. So in mythologizing, that's why there's the reference to a fictional play called Butter Stevenson Helper that I kind of want to exist because I want to see how terrible it would be. So, yeah, so we did that. I think a few of us went in with some general idea or some nagging concept. For me, when I sit down and write, usually there's a concept that just won't leave me alone. Like, it'll wake me up at 4 a.m, or it keeps popping into my head. And it's like I have to exorcise the demon. So that's what I ended up writing about. And there were a few a few concepts from dramaturgy meetings and the writing assignment that made it in, but overwhelmingly the idea was something that I kind of walked in with, and I didn't know if I was going to use it or not, but that's sort of where I ended up going with it.
Right on. And actually, we're going to be joined right now by Amy Escobar, and so we're going to get three people on it, and she's going to be joining on my cell phone, so we're going to have three different kinds of technology happening all at once.
Oh,
it's fantastic. I love it. This is like a comedy of errors. This is all staying in the podcast, guys, because this is freaking brilliant. I love it. So, Dale, as I'm trying to reconnect with Amy, can you talk about your writing process a little bit?
Sure, yeah. It's so funny. Whenever we talk about this, I cannot remember what I pulled out of the hat. Like, I have no idea. I had known going into this process that this might be the avenue for which I could explore the play that I ended up writing. A year ago, I had been unemployed. I decided to leave a company that, while I really enjoyed working for them, the time I was there, it was really clear that there was a big cultural disconnect. And the big cultural disconnect for me was how they treated women. And so I decided to leave when I was offered a pretty good severance package for totally different reasons. And took 2 months off and went on all these job interviews, and I'll never forget this one particular job interview in which he asked me if I could do sweet. And I couldn't believe it. I was floored. It was one of the worst experiences of my life, just like sort of how it made me feel and realizing that I had little to no recourse in the situation. So I decided to turn it into a play, and at the time that it happened, I had written it down, like, verbatim, like, what had happened to me, because I just never wanted to forget. I wanted to, like, post it on blog posts, but it just never seemed like the right avenue. And so when we drew our, pod pairings out of the hat, and I got Courtney as my director, I felt super confident that this was the time to do it. You know, like, I knew Courtney and I had very similar politics, and I knew that this was something that was meaningful to her, and that she has experience doing similar work in an office setting, and so I just started writing, and it was interesting for me to write this particular piece because I'm really used to collaborative creation. So this particular piece, to be a solo playwright again, was really, really hard, and I had to sort of work with Courtney and find the ways that I could be collaborative again, and I'm just really lucky that she understood that and helped me down that path, so it's been fun.
Absolutely. This time we are successfully joined by another one of the playwrights, Amy Escobar. Welcome, Amy.
Hello, sorry to interrupt.
It was funny because I misdialed your number the first time, and I was recording, and it said, this number is incorrect, and so, but I told everyone I'm going to leave it in the podcast because I think it's funny.
Oh, so many technical difficulties. I'm here now, though.
You're here now. Amy, do you want to talk, we've all been talking a little bit about the process of writing the play and choosing some items out of the hat and the writing assignments given by the dramaturgs. Can you talk a little bit about the spark of the idea for your play?
Yeah. What's that? I thought somebody said something. my play came about from a really dark place, actually. I had been flipping through a photo album of my uncle who had passed. He took his own life. He committed suicide when I was about 21. And I was thinking about him a lot during that time. And I was also thinking of a close friend of mine who lived across the country and was having a really hard time. And I didn't really know how to reach her or to, like, be there for her in the way that I felt like she needed as a friend. And I was thinking a lot about these concepts of, like, suicide and depression and feeling dealing with these sort of never-ending trials, and I started writing The Nightmares in my play. And from there, once I had this concept of writing a girl who had to endure nightmares, once I had that idea, I sort of started making a shape for it. And the first thing that I started with was the title. Wasn't the title, Scary Mary and the Nightmares 9. And then from there, I can't really help but infuse things with comedy and theatricality, and I like to make things fun for people to be in. And so it started in this really dark place, and then just kept getting lighter and lighter as I wrote it, which is kind of like a way that I like to do. I like to address serious and dark with light. And I also like the idea of being able to share a story like that with kids if that was ever the case. Annex isn't really like a place that kids come to, but I like the idea of a child being able to see Scary Mary if they so chose to do so. But yeah, that's mostly where it all came from, wanting to address things that I think a lot of people deal with, especially people that I've been around, and I don't know, people have struggles constantly, and I wanted to talk about it in a way that was theatrical and fun.
I mean, I think all of you I've read parts of some of the plays, I've seen Deo's, and so listening to all you talk about it, it's sort of, it's bringing light to some themes, right? Deo's sexism and yours, like you were saying, mental health and depression, and then, Nicole, can you talk a little bit about the premise for your play? Because it sort of is fabulous, and I can't wait to see it executed, but it's a reality cooking show, right? But in the future.
Yes, in addition to being a theater artist, I am a science fiction author. I've had a couple of short stories published, and I occasionally, like, I just finished one about a month ago and sent it out for publication. I haven't heard anything yet, but that's something else that I do, and I'm a really big nerd, so I do a lot of research. I'm really interested in the way technology guides our lives. And one of the biggest themes in my life is food. I think, like a lot of women, I have issues, emotional issues around food. I don't have a diagnosed eating disorder or anything, but I definitely have the sort of, like, you know, I stress eat, and I love to cook, and I love to feed other people, and my boyfriend Matt loves to cook. I learned to cook from my mother, who learned to cook at, like, my grandmother was a terrible cook, but my mom learned to cook at her job at the Hyatt Hotel, so a lot of things were French food-based. So food is something that I think about a lot, and the way that technology changes food and the way that culture guides how we see food are two really big themes in a lot of what I write about. And so doing a cooking show just kind of, like, that's an idea that hit me about a year ago, and I wasn't really sure how I wanted to write about it. And bringing it into the future and showing how our ideas around food in the next 50 to 100 years are just going to radically change, because we have to change the way that we, you know, industrial farming is totally not a sustainable thing at all, but I don't know what is a sustainable practice, because farming itself is not really a sustainable practice. It is actually a major contributor to climate change, so I don't know what the answer is to that, and I don't know that we'll ever get an answer to that, and that's something I've been thinking about for a long, long time, just because we're going to have to deal with that when we're middle-aged and elderly. Like, that's going to be a major thing that's changed in our lives. So I wanted to talk about it, and it ended up being, fortunately, a very absurdist play. I'm not sure if it had ended up being more dramatic, like my solo performance or like some other stories that I've written, if it would have come off as, I think it probably would have come off as like preachy or really depressing, but, because it's very absurdist in the way that like Eugene Ionesco's plays are really absurdist, in that they kind of carry depressing cultural themes, but they're really silly. I think that that probably helped it a lot. And Catherine totally got that. I mean, she doesn't watch cooking shows as obsessively as I do. But she got the ridiculousness and the over-the-topness really, really well, I think. So did that kind of answer your question? That was
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great segue into it. I'd love if each of you could speak about the sort of partner artists that you've been paired with and what that relationship has been, seeing them direct your play and then directing their play. And since none of you can see each other, why don't we start with Deo?
Awesome. Yeah. No, I mean, it's been a dream to work with Courtney. I can't even, you know, I had a big artist crush on Courtney for years, and she, during this process, I found out that she also had the same thing for me. So it's just wonderful, wonderful experience with Courtney. And, you know, I'm sad that she can't be here to contribute and verify my story because I'm like a super big fangirl right now. But, yeah, no, Courtney's been awesome. And I think her writing is just so chock full of subtext. And getting her piece, which she told me constantly, she said, the moment I knew you were my director, I knew I could write my horror play. She's been a longtime fan of my theater company that closed in June, Blood Ensemble, and a lot of the stuff we ended up producing with Blood Ensemble is very, very dark, and so it was really fun for me to have one of my first, you know, post-Blood Ensemble works be a dark piece, you know, that I got to really sort of pull on my previous experience and just sort of really dig into the text that she wrote. I mean, I also looked out and I have this amazing cast, Jordi Montez, Tatiana Favela, who's in the PATP program at UW, and then Cody Smith, and the three of them working together and just pulling apart this text and really, really just leaning into each other and trying new things every rehearsal just was a really fun experience. And I think Courtney learned a lot about it too. You know, she had a lot of questions about how vague she could be, and it was really fun to see how vague we could be as a group together. And it was wonderful. I love her writing.
Awesome. Amy, over to you.
Yeah, she young and I started getting together really early on, and she's never directed before. She's a more of a playwright, and I hadn't done either in a while, and so we were both like, okay, we're in this together, and because I have a little bit more experience directing, I was suddenly the one that was the more experienced one, which was funny to me, and so we were really collaborative and sort of, we're like, okay, we're here for one another. I'm here for you, you're here for me. And really early on, a lot of her, the way that she approached playwriting, the questions that she would ask, really helped me look at my play and shape it. And she took, I believe it was Stephanie Timms, she has a way of asking questions of your play that were really, really helpful. And throughout the rehearsal process, her sort of lack of knowing the actual, like, terminology that actors have, that directors have, would sometimes lead to these, like, beautiful, just really, like, pure insights that I don't think I would have gotten had I worked with somebody who had, you know, 8 shows under their belt this year. And so it ended up being really interesting, the kinds of just like simple notes that she would give that really opened my eyes to how somebody was watching my play. And working with her has been a delight. I feel like we all sort of gained a friend throughout this process. It's like we got paired up with this person who we had to work with side by side for, you know, probably 4 months. And you can't help but develop a friendship in that environment. Jim would, like, drive me home after rehearsal every night, and we'd have these discussions about theater, and she'd ask me all these questions, and it ended up being this incubator for this relationship with this woman in theater who I had no previous relationship to. And one of my favorite things about Chiyoung is that for this project, she decided to step out of her comfort zone in writing and challenge herself to write this, like, drama, as opposed to she usually writes comedies, which is funny because I've never actually seen her plays, and so this is the only play that I know her of, and so I really admire that she took this opportunity as an opportunity to challenge herself and to learn, and it's been a joy to work with her. She's one of the sweetest people I've ever met.
Awesome. And Nicole, can you talk about working with CBS or Catherine Blake Smith?
Sure. So we're both directors, and she's also a stage manager, production manager, producer. I'm also a dramaturg and writer, but not specifically a playwright. Neither of us had actually written a play before, at least for other people. So it was a bit of an adventure, I think, for both of us to sit down and think about how you develop a relationship on the page.
Right.
And my play is not, the play that I wrote is not very conducive overtly to stage relationships. It's very presentational and it's very in the style of cooking shows, but there's not a huge amount, at least in the stage directions, of interaction between the characters. And she found a lot of great moments and allowed the actors to find a lot of really great moments where they interact organically. And I think that that really underscored a lot of what I was trying to get across in the sort of political, cultural wanderings that the characters expressed. And then she handed me this play to direct, Mythologizing Me Like I Do You, that is essentially a seance to banish an ex. And it's so character-driven that it really, it's very much the opposite of the play that I wrote in a lot of ways. It's very much a story about the interactions between these people and how much they care for each other in different ways that we care for each other, how relationships structure themselves differently and how we can inadvertently hurt each other, and bolster each other. We shared casts, as you probably noticed, between the pod groups. So CBS and I have the same four actors. And we got this great cast of four awesome, kind-hearted, open, hilarious people, who work really, really well together. And she and I, in our rehearsals, basically just let them hang out and sort of bullshit with each other for a while. And for me, in Mythologizing, directing that show, that just grew into these really beautiful friendships that you get to watch on stage. And I think that carried over into the play that I wrote, The Strongest Flavor. Whether intentional or not, I think that the relationships they built with each other just in the rehearsal process really shine through and help bolster up that play quite a lot. So it was great. Catherine and I both work organically as directors. We kind of allow actors to find where they're comfortable being on stage and where they're comfortable, and then basically offer encouragement. Yeah, that's a great idea. Keep going. Go further with that. Go further with that. I think I said no to, like, one thing the entire rehearsal process, and it was a very specific staging question where I was like, no, you can't turn your back right here. And that was really about it. So, yeah, so we work really well together. We have complementary directing styles, and being new fawns in the writing process, I think we managed to help re, oh, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm losing words now. reinforce kind of each other's, questions about our scripts and our willingness to go forward with that. So, yeah.
Great. Thanks. And then as we sort of wind this down, I'd like to hear from each of you, why programs like this that, you know, amplify the voices of young female theater artists are important and why people should support them and why it's great that Annex has this as programming. Who would like to start?
I can start again.
Sure.
I guess for me, you know, it's important because 22% of playwrights are women in our, that's like the general broad scope number. I've got a lot of other numbers that I'm hoping to unveil tonight at Spin the Bottle at Annex, but the numbers are skewed, the facts are skewed, especially here in Seattle. We are no exception. There are a ton more women doing this work than there are men in our city, and the men are getting twice as many opportunities for it. That alone is basis enough for this project to exist. But on top of it, when those numbers are the way they are, we need our opportunities to cut our teeth. We need our opportunities to make mistakes, to fall on our faces, opportunities that are maybe a little less high profile, right? This is an off night. It's a Tuesday and Wednesday night. People know when they walk in that door that they are coming to a festival of all these different productions in various states of finished natures. And that's what we need, and that's where we grow. That's how we become the people who get produced and become part of that 22%. We need the opportunity to flex our wings and to talk to each other and have this masterclass type of experience where we are talking with other women who are in similar positions. Maybe me working with Xiang, for instance, who's more a playwright than a director, was super helpful to me because she had tips and tricks on how to be a better playwright, whereas I could maybe give somebody else like Courtney a few tips and tricks on how to be slightly more organized in the director realm or whatever. You know, it was it's an opportunity to get us to the level we need to be at because the opportunities that we are offered are so few and far between. This is important because you're not just coming to see a show that your friend might have directed or written in or acted in. You're coming to see a show that's politically making a statement that we're here to give women opportunities.
Yeah, and to expand that so that 22% ends up being 50% sooner rather than later.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Amy?
Yeah, I don't want to repeat anything Anna just said, but the opportunity that this presented is completely unique and unlike anything I ever experienced before. And the thing about Annex that I love is that Kayleen was so dedicated to not just creating this space for the six of us, but also the designers and the actors. Is it 20 out of 25 people, I think, are the numbers? Are women, the lighting designer, the costume designer, the props designer, all of them are women, and that is something that just, it makes me so happy to be in these rooms full of women. I couldn't believe it. Ian actually said something in the last day of tech that he was happy to be one of the, like, four men that were involved in the process, and for me particularly, having the six women, having Courtney and Dale and Xiang and Nicole and Catherine be a support system throughout this process and be people that I felt like I could ask questions at any time and that I felt like were there for me, that was what I loved the most about it, was that it wasn't just an opportunity for us as women to write a play and direct a play, but it also created this community and this, it sort of was like, look at the other women who are here in the city with you and doing theater. And I don't know, it was so lovely to get to meet all of them and now I feel like I have this community that I didn't have before.
Yeah, Gloria, not to bring Gloria Steinem into this conversation, but She's sort of, I'm reminded of a quote she said, that instead of an old boys club, we need a new girls network. And I really feel like seeing the work and hearing, being able to interview all of you, it seems that's sort of what this is theatrically, and I love it. Nicole, over to you.
All right. I mean, there's definitely the community that Amy mentioned, which is really wonderful. I mean, the thing too about getting a job in Seattle in particular, I've noticed, but in a lot of places is like, you know, if you want to get work, you really need a personal recommendation. And so now I know so many other dynamic, brilliant, incredible women that I can recommend as directors or writers or producers, where I may not have had that knowledge before. And as Deo pointed out, the statistics for, you know, women's involvement in leadership roles and creative roles in theater is just abysmal. There's no excuse. We're 51 or 52% of the population globally. There's more women than there are men, just by a small percentage. And there's 22% of plays produced in a given year in the U.S. are by women. Like, that's not cool, guys. And what I would say in addition to that, there's been a little discussion of this lately, and I think it's going to blossom into an interesting discussion, but redefining what neutral means in media in general and on stage specifically. When you think of neutral, when you think of every man, for example, you think of some white dude,
right,
probably in his 30s. And that's kind of the neutral character for us as a culture. And I think that it's really, really important to for productions like ZigZag, because then the neutral, both on stage and behind the scenes, which is equally important, is not some white dude in his 30s or 40s. It's a bunch of women. It's women of color. It's queer people. It's gender neutral people. It's like, you know, there is no neutral because we actually represent a lot of different types of people. So I think that ZigZag has been very intentional about that. And I think it's important still right now to be intentional about those decisions, but we, you know, our neutral was not the standard cultural neutral. Our neutral was much more representative of the actual population. So I think that more of these types of projects need to happen.
Absolutely. Was there something you wanted to add, Dale?
No, I just said seconded.
Seconded. Amy, can we get a third?
What's that?
Just,
what do you mean?
Can we get a third?
Get a what?
Get a third, like we're nominating something in, like, the Congress or something. I guess you wouldn't. You would just second something.
Oh,
you wouldn't third something.
What do I say? I third this.
Yes. There you go.
I do. I said it.
Well, thank you, all three of you, for sitting down with me for a couple minutes today. As we've said before, the show runs for 2 more weeks on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. You can get more information at nxtheater.org and go out and support this dynamic, important work that's happening in our community. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We really appreciate all the work you've done supporting us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.